Okay, so let's get started here. I hope the assignment went okay, barring last minute questions about HLAB that some people had. There's nothing else, right, to consider. Any comments? I'm going to have to hand out the next one soon. So if you have any comments, this is a time to convey them to me before I put out the next one. How many of you worked in groups? Because a few of you have worked individually. So the thing to keep in mind is it would be still good if you want to form a group. You don't have to. It's optional, but it's good if you want to, because the subsequent ones will not only build on this, but also get a little more involved. So if you work in groups, you can reduce your own workload. Okay, but again, it's not mandatory. It's just recommended. Right? So I will also have to hand out a homework shortly. An email, send out an email as soon as the homework is posted on the web page. Okay. So let's continue where we left off last time. So we had started this new chapter on canonical problems in distributed systems. And last time we spent much of the class talking about clock synchronization. Okay. The notion of time. Why is time important in a distributed system? You need to be able to reason about the order in which certain things happen. And if your application is running on multiple machines, okay, and the clocks on those machines need to be synchronized. Otherwise, if you just use local timestamps, comparing those timestamps becomes meaningless, okay, if they are not synchronized a priori. So we looked at this problem of how do you do clock synchronization. We looked at several algorithms, the Berkeley algorithm, the Christian's algorithm. Some use a time server, some are distributed. And then we also looked at how GPS is used to do both clock synchronization as well as compute the location of a GPS receiver. Okay, that's basically a recap of what we did last time. So today we are going to look at this notion, or continue this discussion on clocks, but look at the notion of what is called a logical clock as opposed to a physical clock. So we'll look at what's called several instances of logical clock. So when you typically say logical clock, people mean a specific instance of a logical clock called Lamport's clock. Okay, they tend to be synonymous, but in reality, there are many types of logical clocks. So we'll look at Lamport's clocks, and then we'll look at another one called vector clocks. And we'll see how some of these ideas can be used determine what's the global state of a computation. Okay, so three canonical problems: Lamport's clocks, vector clocks, and global state determination. So let's first try to understand what is a logical clock or why do we need it. Okay. So the problem of clock synchronization, at this point we understand. Okay. We also know that clock synchronization is not going to be perfect. Okay. Any clock synchronization algorithm is going to have some error. Okay. And if your application requires an accuracy that is smaller than the error of that clock synchronization algorithm, then your application will malfunction, because the clock synchronization is not giving you the level of synchronization you need. And this problem you can never solve. You can make the clock synchronization algorithm more accurate, but then you may come up with an application that needs even better accuracy. So it's never such, and you can never get perfect synchronization. Okay. So then you have to ask, is there a different way to solve this problem? Okay. And that's what we are going to look at today. So what we will see are techniques that allow you to understand what order events have happened, even when clocks are not synchronized. So we'll assume that you have unsynchronized clocks, and yet you want to be able to run applications on machines with unsynchronized clocks and yet do something useful in terms of time. And then the question is, what do you assume and what can you do? Okay. And the basic insight behind all of these logical clocks is as follows. So for many problems, the internal consistency of clocks is important, but absolute time is not. Okay. So what does that mean? So what that essentially means is, what are you using the timestamps for in many distributed applications? You are using that basically to determine the order in which certain events have happened. Okay? The timing of those events may not be important for your application. If it is important, then you do need real clocks and clock synchronization. But if you are just using timestamps to figure out whether this event happened before some other event or vice versa, then you don't really need physical clock. You just need to agree on this is the order. And if everybody agrees that was the order, then you are done. You don't really need. So to go back to your project, what do you use the notion of time for? Okay, when you retrieve all messages that were posted, you specify a time. And what you want are all of the messages that have been posted after that point in time. Okay? So you just basically, all you're specifying is a point in your timeline, and you're saying, send me all the posts that have happened after this. The exact time may not be very important. All you want to do is what has happened before, which posts were before and which posts were after this point. You only want the subset that have occurred after. Okay? So what, in other words, what you need time there for was to reason about the order of event. Okay, what has happened before and what's happened after. Okay. So the key idea is, if you just want that and you don't really care about real time, okay, then you don't need clock synchronization. If you do care about real time, like if you want to compute the response time, or you want to actually do something based on real time, that something has happened, saying what has happened after noon, you actually care about the time noon, not just an arbitrary point, then you need clock synchronization. But if you are just trying to reason about ordering of events, then clock synchronization need not be absolute. And we will use a notion of an abstract clock called a logical clock, okay, which will allow us to do this. Okay. And how do we do this? Okay. So the basic point is, if there are two machines that are not interacting at all, okay, then you don't need to synchronize them at all. Okay, even synchronize their logical clocks. Physical clocks, we are assuming, are not synchronized. Okay. Only machines that interact do need some way to figure out order in which events have happened. Okay. If there are two independent machines that don't interact with at all, we don't care about what their physical clocks say, nor do we care about what their logical clocks say. Okay. Because if they don't interact, that means there's no application, there's a component that are running on those two that talk to one another. So then we don't care about those machines. Those are independent machines. Only where they do interact, we do care. Okay. So now if you want to do this, we have this notion of, or we have defined this notion of an event ordering. Okay, so the problem is to determine a total order of all the events that have happened in the system. This is a distributed system. The applications running on multiple machines, their clocks are not synchronized, and each process on those machines sees a set of events. Okay? Events could be post a message, retrieve a message. These are all events in your first programming assignments that you care about. Okay? So if you could determine a total ordering of all of the events in the system, you know, across all applications, then your problem is solved. You know all the order in which events have happened. You basically can say which event happened before which other event, and you can reason about the ordering of events in the system. Okay. So how do we do this? Okay. Now again, if you have a single machine, okay, centralized application, there is no problem. Okay. You can just use the local clock on those machines, just timestamp every event, and by definition, all the events get totally ordered. Okay, because it's a single clock. Okay. And it's consistent. All applications are using the same clock, so timestamps are directly comparable. Okay. Now, if you had multiple applications, multiple machines, and you have events, applications running on those machines, if you just use the local clock to timestamp and you compare this, that doesn't tell you anything because the clocks are not synchronized. Okay. Is that clear? If you don't have synchronized clock, you just timestamp using the local clock, and you take the timestamp on two machines, and I ask you, is this event, did it happen before that event? You cannot say. Those clocks are not synchronized to begin with. Okay, now how can you determine the ordering of events if the clocks are not synchronized? How can you reason about this? Okay, so the answer is on the slide. So if you just read the slide, you will see. Okay. So we will assume, just before I say that, we will assume there is no global clock in the system. Local clocks are not synchronized, hence you cannot order events on different machines using local time. But here is the key insight that you can use to determine an event order. And that is by using the notion of messages. Okay, we'll assume that the application interact with one another using messages. You can send a message and the message gets received. Okay. So what can you say when a message is sent and when a message is received at the other end? Yes.
You say time on the sender when it was sent and time on the receiver when it was received.
Yes, what can you say about those times?
You say that that was the receiver time tells you when that event came in your local time, and the sender time tells you when the event came in the sender's time.
Yes.
So you can use that to order the sender's events and your events.
Okay. So basically, the idea is if you use messages, okay, to communicate, and you can use a fundamental principle, exactly what was said, but let me restate that in a much simpler way. You can use a fundamental principle saying the send of a message and the receive of a message are two events. Okay? By law of physics, you cannot send the message before it is received. Okay? The receive event has to happen after the send event. Yeah, because it's going to take a finite amount of time, no matter how small, for the message to be transmitted from the sender to the receiver. Even if the clocks are not synchronized, I know this much, that the send has to have happened before the receive. Okay? So you can use this very simple observations to now derive ordering of events across machines. And the example that I'll draw is as follows. So let's assume so this is time. This is process on machine A, process on machine B. Okay, these are just events, arbitrary events. Okay. If there's no communication between this, if I point to you to this event and ask you in what order they happened, you don't know. Okay. But if the message goes from A to B, then I can derive, I can say something about those events. Okay? Not all the events, but certain events. In particular, I know that this send and this receive are ordered. Okay? This send has to have happened before the receive. Okay? Regardless of whether the clocks are synchronized or not, we don't care. I mean, this is clear. Okay? Now, internally within a process also, events are ordered. Okay? Because this is a sequentially executing process. So within this process, I know this event has happened after that event because it's sort of later in the timeline. Okay, is that clear? So within a process, events are ordered. Across processes, if there is a message that goes from one process to another, you know that the send has to have happened before the receive. Okay? Now you just use transitivity from this point on. So now if I ask you what can you say about this event and this event, you should be able to say something. Yeah. If you know that this one has happened before this one because it's local, you know this one has happened before that one because that's local, and you know that this one has happened before this one. So now you use transitivity. Now I point you to two different events or two independent machines. Clocks are not synchronized and ask what is the relationship between this event and that event. And you know this has happened before that, yeah, because of this message exchange. Okay? So this is the basic idea that we will use. Because messages go from process, one process to another, you can order the send and the receive, you can order events locally within each process. Now you can start reasoning about events in a distributed systems on machines with unsynchronized clocks. Okay, that's the basic idea. Okay? So we will formalize all of this using this notion of happened before relationship. So if A and B are two events, okay, you have this relationship which says A happened before B. And this is true in the following cases. Okay, if A and B are events in the same process and A executes before B, then you know A happened before B. Okay, that's the local events within a process. Okay, if A executed before B, sequentially executing process, so A happened before B. A represents the send, B represents the receive, and A happened before B. And the relation is transitive. A happened before B, B happened before C, that implies A happened before C. Okay? Relation is not defined across processes that does not exchange messages. Okay? This is a partial ordering of events, not a total ordering. Okay? So in particular, if I ask you again about this event and that event, what can you say about this? Nothing, because there is no message exchange here. You cannot say anything. The only thing you can do is order events along this timeline, along the black line. Okay? You cannot reason about this event and this event. You cannot reason about this event and that event. Okay? But you can reason about all events that are along that dark line. Okay? So it's a partial ordering, not a total ordering. But as there are more messages, you can derive additional orderings. Okay? That's the basic idea. So given this happened before relationship, here is a problem we want to address. Okay, now we'll come back to this notion of clock synchronization and whatnot. So we'll assume that what you want is a notion of a logical clock, not a physical clock, it's just a logical clock that will allow you to timestamp event. Okay, for simplicity, we'll assume that the logical clock is an integer, okay, that ticks every time there is an event that you care about. Okay, so the clock just increments 1, 2, 3. It takes only when there are events you care about. If there are no events, the clock does not have to tick. Okay? So now you want to use this clock and you want to timestamp every event. Okay? And you want the following property. If A has happened before B, you want to assign it a timestamp, which is called a clock value at event A. That's just less, strictly less than the clock value of event B. Okay, so if A is an event that happened before B, you want to derive a clock algorithm that will timestamp events A and B such that you are guaranteed that the clock value of A is less than the clock value of B. Okay, is that clear? How to do that, we haven't said. I mean, this is just the problem. Okay, if A and B are concurrent events, which means you cannot reason about the order, then you don't care about what clock values. The clock values can be greater than, less than, or equal to, as I said in the second statement here. So in particular, I do want the property that the clock value of this event has to be less than the clock value of that event, because that event has happened before that. But if you are asking me about the clock value here and here, I don't care what the clock values are. Okay, it could be less than, equal to, or greater than. Since there is no relationship between them, I don't care about them. Okay, so the algorithm is mentioned here, and I'll just say what that is. It's a very simple algorithm. Okay, so this is time. Okay, so locally, each process maintains an integer, which is its local logical clock. Okay, we'll say LC of I is the logical clock of process I in the system. There could be an arbitrary number of processes. Each one has an integer value. Okay? That is its logical clock. It's an integer counter. It ticks every time there's a local event. So for every local event, just increment the logical clock. Okay? Whenever you send a message, okay, in addition to the message, you are going to piggyback your logical clock value. Okay? So this is a message that has gone from this process to this process. In addition to the message itself, you will actually send the logical clock value at the send time. Okay, this guy will say, this is my clock value when I did the send. Okay, so the message will always piggyback the logical clock. So this is what it says. And I send the message to J, piggyback the logical clock of I. Okay, and this is what you do on the receive. Whenever you do a receive, what you do is the logical clock value of J is the max of LC of I, LC of J plus 1. Okay? So you will take the clock value that has arrived on the message, you will look at your local clock value, you will take the max of the two. Okay, that's the max of these two, I and J, add 1, and that is your new clock value. Okay? Is that clear? So what does this give you? Yes? So as we said, because the send has happened before the receive, you want a property such that if A happened before B, you want to timestamp A and B so that that property holds. Okay? That's precisely what we have done here. Okay? So you know that the logical clock value here, okay, was LC of A. You send that here. So here you basically did max of the logical clock value that came with the message and your logical clock. And this is the timestamp you have assigned here. So this ensures that the receipt timestamp is strictly greater than the send timestamp. That's all you have done. Okay, by just doing the max here. Okay, so by doing this, you have basically gotten the property we want. Okay, along this dark line, the logical clock values will always increment. Okay, they may not always increment by 1, but they will be strictly increasing. Okay, here in particular, it could jump. Okay, because you are doing a max, could increase by an arbitrary amount, but they will always increase, monotonically increase along that. timeline. Is that clear? Yes, question.
This line doesn't mention the use of the maximum function. Is that an error?
No, actually this also gives you the same thing. It is basically just doing LC of I plus 1. So it's just checking here. The less than and only then it does that. It doesn't matter. If you, because you're doing the max, it's the same thing. You're only checking if one is less than the other and then you add one to the one that came on the wire. So that's the same as doing the max. Okay, is this clear what we have done? Okay, this algorithm is called Lamport's Law. Okay, named after Leslie Lamport, who first proposed this algorithm. Okay, Leslie Lamport, incidentally, is the same guy who wrote LaTeX. Okay, so it's just a side note. Okay, so now what does this give us, or what does it not give us? So here is a simple picture that shows the same thing. Three processes, what are the numbers that are showing are their logical clocks. Every time you send a message here, okay, you send your clock value. Okay? So here you see that when this sent message here, 60 came. Here the logical clock has only advanced till 48. So after the receipt, it becomes 61. Okay, because you took the max of 48 and 60 and you added 1. Okay. Same thing happens here. So you send a message, so this is 69, okay, goes over the wire. You take a max of 69 and 48 because the logical clock here is this, and this becomes 70. Okay, so exactly what I showed there. And now if you take any path, so you can actually go, because it's a transitive relationship, you can say something about this event and that event, for instance. Okay. You know that that event happened before this event because there's a message that went here, the message that went here. You use transitivity, you basically go down that path and say this event has happened before that event. Okay? Now there's something to keep in mind. If I give you, let's say, this event which has timestamp of 24, okay, and I give you this event which has a timestamp of 32, what can you say about those events? So you cannot say anything because there is no happen before relationship. These are called concurrent events. There is no message that has been exchanged that allows me to draw this timeline. Okay? So just by looking at this clock value, you can't say this guy has timestamp 32. This is 24, so now I compare them because there was some message exchange in the past. You can't do that. Okay? You need this strict happen before relationship that was defined, as I had said earlier, that within a process you can order events. Across processes you can only order events using message exchange. Okay? Message exchange can be transitive. This is an important point to keep in mind. Okay, so let me come back to totally ordered multicasting, but I'll just say something about, so this is what, so the advantage of this is as follows. You have machines with no clock synchronization at all, okay, yet you are able to reason about some ordering of events. That's a good thing. Okay, you got rid of clock synchronization and you could still say something about event. The bad thing, not, I shouldn't say bad, but a limitation of the approach is that what we have essentially done is if A has happened before B, we have timestamped A such that and B such that the clock value of A and the clock value of B, C of A is less than C of B. Okay? That's an implication that goes in that direction. Okay? The reverse is not true. Because if this is true, then this is true. That doesn't say anything about if that is true, what has happened, what can you say about A and B. This was precisely why if I showed you these two timestamps, 24 and 32, and ask you what can you say about these two events, looking at this picture or just looking at those timestamps, at least you cannot say anything. Okay. But what you actually want in your application is that reverse implication. Given timestamps, you want to be able to compare them and say this is what has happened before. That's really what you want. Okay. This has only given you one direction. If you knew that this had happened before the other one, somehow if you knew that, then you can say the timestamps are ordered in some way. But in reality, what you want is the reverse. Okay. You want to be able to give me two timestamps, I can tell you if this event happened before that or vice versa. That you cannot do here. Okay? And so, That's exactly what is said here. In Lamport's clocks, if A happened before B, then C of A is less than C of B. The reverse is not true. Nothing can be said about events by comparing their timestamps. Okay? In particular, if C of A is less than C of B, then nothing can be said about it. And we want to derive that property. Okay? This property is called causality. Okay? So if A happened before B, then we say A is causally related to B. Okay, there's a causal dependence between A and B. Okay, and we want to capture this property in an algorithm that we are going to look at next. Okay. And here is another property. This is called causality. If A happened before B, is causal delivery says if send of M happened before send of N, where M and N are two messages, then the delivery of M also happened before delivery of N. Very simply stated, what this is saying is that messages are sent out in a certain order, they are received in the same order. You can't have messages crossing. So one send has happened before another send, so some process actually receives them in a different order. The one that was sent later is received first. If you can avoid that, then you have what's called causal delivery. So messages are sent in the, or messages are received in the order that they were sent. That's a textual way of saying this same thing here.
Well, that doesn't always happen. Like in BGP,
yes. So point that is being made here is in UDP, you can send messages in certain order and you will receive them in different order. That tells you UDP does not give you causal delivery. Yeah, I'm saying if you want this property is called causal delivery. We haven't said how to implement that in a protocol. TCP does give you that. UDP does not. TCP gives you that for pairs of processes. It doesn't give it for arbitrary collections of processes. Okay. So now what we need is the following. Okay. We need a time stamping mechanism. We need a new algorithm that is going to give us this property. If timestamp of A is less than strictly less than timestamp of B, just by looking at this timestamp, it should be guaranteed that A should have causally preceded B. We want this property from our algorithm. Lamport's law did not give us. It actually gave us the forward implication, not the reverse. So now we want to derive the reverse. Any questions on this? How to do that, we'll see in a moment. But it should be clear what we are trying to do. Okay, again, we will assume no clock synchronization. Okay? We want some way of implementing a logical clock that is going to give us that property. Yes, your question.
I'm trying to say that when one event occurs, one message is passed, the events occurring after that will also be can also be compared with respect to a exchange of messages. But that's not the true the diagram issue.
Right. So okay, let me restate the problem. Okay. So it's not the case that we will, if you have a timestamp. So what is the relationship between these two in terms of causality? There is no relationship, they are concurrent events. Okay? So in this case, we will not care about the timestamps. Okay? If timestamp of A is less than timestamp of B, okay, then we want guarantee that A should have causally preceded B. Okay? To implement that property, you need a timestamping mechanism such that these two should not be comparable. They should neither be less than nor be greater than, and we'll see how to do that. Because if it's less than, then they become causally preceded. But this is not true looking at this. Okay? So you want to preserve the properties, not that suddenly you will now be able to reason about these two events. They are concurrent. Okay? And you want a timestamping mechanism that tells you that they are concurrent. Okay? So in particular, the timestamping mechanism will tell you what is the causal dependence. It will also tell you when they are concurrent and hence they are not comparable. Okay? Is that clear? So in particular, this mechanism is not going to work because it's integer. It allows you to directly compare. Okay? 24 is less than 32. Okay, if this was the right mechanism, this would have told you this event actually happened before that event. But looking at this picture, that's not the case. You should have a mechanism that somehow says this timestamp and this timestamp are not comparable. Hence, they are concurrent events. If they are comparable, then that imposes an ordering of those events. And we'll see that. We'll actually, once you do the algorithm, it will be clear how this is done. Okay, so here is the new algorithm. It's called vector clocks. A straightforward extension of logical clocks. Okay. So let's go to the detail later. Let me give you an intuition of what is being done here. Every process now doesn't keep one integer, it keeps n integers. Okay, so and there are n clock values. There's one for itself and there's one integer for every other process in the system. Let's assume there are n processes, so that's a vector of n integers. Okay, this is called a vector clock. Okay, so think of it as an array that is maintained by A. There's a similar vector that's maintained at B. There's n entries, so you can index any entry and that tells you what you know about the ith element of the array. Okay, so local events, you do the same thing, you increment your entry. Yeah, so in this case, let's say, I guess, so if you have process I and you have local events, you only increment the ith entry, not do nothing about the other entries in the vector. Okay, is that clear what I just said? Because there's one entry per process for in within each vector. For local events, you just increment your entry in your vector. Okay, that's the ith entry. If you have process I, you will increment the ith entry. Okay. Again, when you send a message, you will piggyback the whole vector with the message. Okay, same as before. When you receive the message, you now have two vectors. Okay, you will compare entry by entry and you will take the max of those entries. Okay, again like before, we basically said max of So here is what it says. When you receive a message, you have two vectors, you look at each entry and your vector clock is now set to the max of each individual entry. Okay, so just a straightforward generalization of logical clock. Local events increment your clock. In this case, you increment your entry in the vector. When you send a message, send the clock value. When you receive a message, you have two vectors, do a comparison of each individual entry and take the max, and that's the new vector. Okay, that's the algorithm. That's all you have to do. Okay, and of course you have to increment your own. After you do this, you take your entry and increment by one. Okay, you have to do that as well. Because remember, in the logical clock, it was max of A, B plus one. So you do all the max and then you take your own, the jth entry, and you increment that. Okay, so now what has this given us? That's the sort of the mechanics of the algorithm, but let's try to understand what it is trying to do. Any thoughts on what this is doing? So if there are only two processes, yes.
So the counter for your local counter for each of the other processes is strictly increasing.
Yes, true. The local counter for each process is strictly increasing. Absolutely true. Okay. Now think about what is the local counter for some other process telling me.
They are at least that value.
Yes. So it tells you multiple things. So if I know, let's just erase this for a second. Okay. Let's say the vector is 2, 3. This is my entry. Okay. And this is the entry for A. Okay. What does that 2 tell me? What does it mean? Okay, it tells you two events have occurred. Good. What else does it tell you?
And from then forward, that's all non-resolution
can happen. Okay. True. What does it tell you about message exchange? Number of events is less than what are you saying? Rate of events. What does it tell you about the rate? Okay. So, how could you have ever gotten that value to increment to 2? Locally, you don't increment anyone else's counter when there are local events. So only one time you increment someone else's counter in your vector if some message arrived. Okay. So what does that tell you? It tells you that there was some message that A sent out at time 2. That's why your counter has actually gotten incremented at 2. So the last time you heard from A was basically when its local clock was 2. That's why your thing has actually incremented. So this may not be a direct message. Okay? It may be an indirect set of messages. A may have sent a message to, let's say, process D. D may have sent it to E. Eventually this has come. So it has tricked. It may have trickled through multiple messages. But that doesn't matter. You know it through transitivity that some message that has come from A has eventually reached B, and the time at which that message was sent was 2. That's what you know. Okay? So essentially what your vector is telling you is not only how far your clock has advanced, it tells you something about how much other processes clocks have advanced as well. At times they have sent messages to someone in the system. Okay? If they are not sending messages, you don't know about how much, let's say, process A's clock has advanced. But the moment A sends out a message, because A has to send out its clock value, you now know something about the clock at message A, process A. So essentially this vector is not telling you how far have clocks advanced in the system the last time anyone sent a message to someone else. Okay, either it's a direct message or it's a sequence of messages that you have received, because when you have A sending to D and D sending and so on, A is still transmitting some information to B via this, say, sequence of messages. Okay, because each one is going to increment their vector based on that vector that's come or the message. So information is propagating through the system. Okay, through this notion of vector clocks. Okay, that is basically what this tells you. Now let's go back and try to understand, did we actually get the property we wanted? If V of A is less than V of B, are we guaranteed? Okay, with this insight, are we guaranteed that A has causally preceded B? Okay, so let's take two vectors and compare them. Okay, first we have to define what A, vector of A less than vector of B means. This is a vector dependent, not an integer, right? Let's say okay, so let's say 1, 0. Here are two vectors. Okay. What does it tell you about these two events? Yes.
It tells you that the second event on the second machine happened after the.
So this is a timestamp of an event, because each event now has a vector timestamp, not a single scalar timestamp. So this is a timestamp of some event in the system, this is a timestamp of some other event in the system.
So the second event happened later in the process of the second machine.
Okay. Second event has happened later. Okay. Now you should say you can't tell because you haven't defined the less than relationship for vectors. So let me first define that, only then you can actually say something about this. Okay. So we will say that V of A is strictly less than V of B if, okay, for all elements I, okay, less than or equal to V of I, and there exists a J such that V of A less than or. Okay. This is just saying, how do you compare two vectors? You can compare two vectors and say that one vector is less than the other if every element in the first vector is less than or equal to every element in the second vector. There's at least one element in the first vector that's strictly less than. Okay, that's what you mean by less than. That all entries can be the same or less than, but there should be at least one entry that's strictly less than. Okay. Is that clear? So by this definition, this vector is less than that vector, because this is comparable, this is equal, but this is strictly less than that. So this vector is less than that vector. Okay? So now we have a case where V of A is less than V of B, because this vector is less than this. Okay? Now does that tell you that this event happened before this event? Because that's the property we want. And why does it tell you something? Yes.
Yes, because they both have the same value in the first process, so it doesn't tell you anything. But in the second process, the second one came after the first one.
Right.
And so if they're at the same time on the first one, that means that as far as the first one's concerned, they're equal or greater than, but the second one, you know, it's greater than. So.
Right. So what should be clear is, because these two entries are identical, okay, the only difference is in this, these two entries, okay, and so these two entries are basically local to a process, okay, and this is less than this, so I should tell you. So in other words, what you have is basically something like, you have 1, 0, you have 1, 2, so these are actually this event and this event, okay. But what is interesting is, you can take any two arbitrary vectors. If V of A is less than V of B, then you can actually try to understand why this event happened before this event. Because as I said, what are these values telling you? They're telling you about what has happened in the system. So you know that A has sent out a message at time 1. That's why my entry for A is showing 1. Okay? So you can reason about each event and each of your entries, and if everything is less than something else, it tells you something about the order of events. Okay? So in particular, if this was like this, 1, 0 and 2, 2, okay? This tells you that this event, okay, tells you that I heard from A at time 2 and here I heard from A at time 1, okay? And this is basically strictly less than this. So you know this event, you have heard something more about the system for this other process, and your own clock has also ticked further. So this should have preceded, this should have happened after that event. Okay. So this is how you will reason about event. Okay. Is that clear? Okay. So now let's come back and ask the question, what can you say about these two events? Yes. Okay, true. To reason about these two events, you have to compare the vector clocks. What do you think will be the values of the vector clocks? Yes.
So the first value in the first one will be greater because it went on after it sent the message.
Mm-hmm.
And the second value in the second one will be greater because it continued on after it received the message. So basically, both of them have one value that's greater than the other. So there will be none that has all less than one greater.
I just put some vector timestamps. It's exactly the example that was given here. So what can you do? Compare these timestamps and say, is this is less than that or that is less than the other one? Should be neither. Right? Because if this is less than this should have causally preceded this. If it's the other way around, then the other should be true. So you want vectors that are not comparable either way. So that means some elements are more and other entries are less. So here you can see this entry is greater than that entry, but that's less. Okay? So it's neither the case that this is less than that, nor is it the other way around. Okay? So that should also tell you that vectors, if I give you two vectors, it's not that, unlike two integers, if I give you two integers, one is going to be less than the other or the other way around. But in vectors, it's not the case. You cannot have two vectors that's always either this way or the other way. They may not be comparable at all. So some entries may be more, others may be less. So the vector is neither more nor less than the other vector. You cannot say anything about the vector. And that's precisely why you have this condition, because neither is it less nor it is the other. You cannot say anything whether V of A is less than V of B or the other way around. So that tells you these are concurrent events. This is exactly what we want, because the events are concurrent. Okay? Just by looking at the timestamps, you know that they are concurrent, because the timestamps are not comparable. If the timestamps are comparable and you get this, you know that there is an ordering between the events. Okay? So in other words, you have gotten the reverse property we wanted. Okay? We have found a way to timestamp events such that if I give you the timestamps, here they are vector timestamps, okay, and you compare those timestamps, you know whether some event happened before some other event or the events are concurrent. Okay, there are two alternatives. Either this happened before relationship or the events are concurrent. And you can compare the vector timestamps and actually reason. And that's the property we really wanted. Okay? Again, remember that none of this was done using any clock synchronization algorithm. Okay? These are just using this abstract notion of a logical clock, which is essentially an integer that ticks whenever there's a local event. Okay? It has no relationship to physical time on the system. Okay? Okay, so here is an algorithm that, so the previous algorithm actually told you how to do vector clocks and how to reason about it. So here was yet another property. This was a stronger property. This said you want causal delivery. Okay, you want messages to be received in the order that they were sent. Okay, vector clocks doesn't do anything about message delivery. Messages are sent and received whenever you want. All you can do is compare timestamps on event. If in addition to doing that, you want a property that says if send of A happened, send of M happened before send of N, then delivery of M has to happen before delivery of M. It's guaranteed that messages are received in the order that they were sent, even if they are sent by arbitrary processes. Okay. Within a process, if you adjust, this is easy to do. Yeah, like TCP does this for you, it doesn't need vector timestamps or anything like that. Okay. But if you arbitrary sets of processes, okay. So, okay. So if there's A, B, C, A sending a message this way, C sending a message this way. If you know that this send has happened before this send because of some other relation, prior message exchange in the system, then this delivery is going to happen before that. Again, because of some prior message exchange. So if you have vector timestamps that allow you to compare, okay, the vector timestamp of this event and vector timestamp of that event, and if you can say that this vector timestamp is less than that, then you need an algorithm that guarantees that the vector timestamp on this is less than that. Okay? Independent of which processes. So this is the algorithm here. So all you have to do is the following. Whenever you receive a message from some other process, okay, you will buffer the message, okay, until you have gotten all messages you have missed. Okay. Somehow by looking at this timestamp, you should be able to reason that there was some message that was sent in the system that you have not received. In other words, you should just be able to look at this vector timestamp and say, this is a message that's come out of order. So I'm going to hold this message until all the messages that I have missed so far are actually going to come, and I'm going to deliver them in that order. That's the basic idea. Yeah, that's what this is saying. Whenever you receive a message, okay, from some other process, look at its timestamp. Just by looking at that timestamp, if you can figure out there are some other messages I have missed, okay, then I should hold that message, delay delivery of the message until I receive all the missed messages. How do you do this? The way you do this in this system is every message that you send is not only sent to the receiver you intended to, you also multicast that message to everyone. Okay. Just to tell everyone that here is a message I sent to process B. Okay. And on this, you also piggyback your vector timestamps. Okay. So essentially every message is getting broadcast to every other process in the system. Okay. Just for processing a vector timestamp. Okay. The message itself is only intended for one recipient. But you just send this to everyone. It's equivalent to saying send the message to that process but broadcast your vector timestamps. You don't need to send the payload of the message to everyone, but at least send a vector timestamp saying this is a message I sent, this is the timestamp on the message that I piggyback. So if you do this and then you get a message message with the vector timestamp, you can actually look at that vector timestamp and compare it to your own, and you can figure out what does the sending process know that I don't know. Okay? If the, in particular, if the sending process, let's say there are three processes. Okay? So this is the vector timestamp that has come to me. This is my local time, let's say I am process 3. Okay. This is my local timestamp. Okay. Just by looking at this, what can I say about this process? Or actually let me, So what this tells me is this process 1 that sent me the message actually heard from this other second process. Okay, is received a message that I have not yet received, because his timestamp for 2 is higher than mine. Okay, and because you have causality, okay, this guy received, and this message was received before the sending of the message that has come to me. Okay, this tells me that some message has been received in the system that I have not yet seen. So I have received this message out of order. Yeah, so I can delay this message and wait for that message from that process that this process has already seen, which is why it's reflected in its timestamp. wait for it to come, and then I send the message in that order. Because vector timestamps are telling you what do you know about every other process in the system, you know that this process knows something about a third process that I don't yet know. And because that process already knows it before he sent me this message, I should also know it before I receive this message. Otherwise, you are out of order delivery.
So the only one that can increment is from the one that was sent to you. The first one could be longer. You don't care about that.
Yes, that's fine. Okay, so you can look at this timestamp and you can reason because they tell you something about ordering of events. So you can in particular detect that there are messages you are receiving out of order. This is just one example of how you could use vector clocks to enforce in-order sort of causal delivery of messages in the system. Okay, there are other examples that we will see as well. Is that clear? Okay, the picture is actually showing an example where this message was received here. That's precisely the example I gave. This message came here. Subsequently, this process actually sent this message. But it was not received because this process has not received the same message. That's that message is still in transit. Okay? But you know that this guy has actually gotten this message. These two events are ordered. So this receive happened before this send. Okay? So you want the same thing. You want the receive to be happened before this one. So you will delay this. So that's why you hop and you sort of wait until it comes. Okay? Same thing shown in pictures. Okay, this is called causal delivery of messages. Okay, is that clear? Any questions on this? Okay, so now we are going to move to a third. So go back and look at the material again on Lamport's clock, vector clock and causal delivery. Okay? Sometimes it is not very easy to understand. If that is the case, come back and ask questions because it's important that you understand this, because a lot of the subsequent material will say, okay, we know how to do logical clock and we'll use that, or we'll use vector clocks to do this. So if this very basic building block is not clear, some of the later discussion will not make sense. Okay? So if it's not clear, ask questions now, or if something comes up later, do review this material because we'll build on it. Okay? Alright. So here is a. So now we are going to switch gears and look at this problem of global state. Okay. So, and we'll try to understand why we even care about this notion of a global state. First, let me define what is global state, and then we'll worry about why we care at all. Okay. So the global state of a distributed system is the local state of each process. Okay. Local state being the in-memory state of that process, as well as all the messages that are sent but have not been received. Okay, these are the messages in transit. Okay. So very simply, a global state of a distributed system is a local state of each process and all the messages in transit. Okay. Now why do I care? I mean, what does this mean? Okay. So it turns out that in many scenarios, you need to know what is the global state of the system. Okay. And this is required for failure recovery, distributed deadlock detection and so on. Okay. And why do we want to know? So let's assume that you have a distributed simulation. Okay? You are running a simulation consisting of multiple processes that run on independent machines. Okay? Let's assume it's a long running simulation. It takes, let's say, 2 days for the computation to end. Okay? Let's say that after the first day, let's assume there are 10 processes. After the first day, one process crashed. So the process has gone down. Okay. So what do you do?
Restart.
So your 1 day of work is wasted. You restart. Next day the same thing happens.
Find the bug in the code.
Find the bug in the code. Fine, maybe there's a hardware fault that's causing it. No, you can debug. So that's fine, but now, wouldn't it be nice if you could restart the whole simulation from just the point before it crashed? So you did not waste your time and restart the whole thing. Okay. Obviously, better property. I don't have to sort of say all of this work is gone to waste. It could be an arbitrary time. Right? It could be 10 days and it crashed after the 9 days. So 9 days of work is wasted. Okay. So how do you do it? How do you go and say, I'm going to restart the computation at this point? Yes.
Well, if you have a global state, you just start up all the processes where they were, and all the messages that were trying to then be received and continue.
Okay, no, so you are jumping ahead. You're looking at the definition of global state. Intuitively, what could you do is the issue.
Store states of the system. Right. Look at every cool internal, and you just monitor that after system time, and
That's the intuition. The intuition, I mean, what you will use is global state to do this. The intuition is every so often you want to checkpoint your state, saying I have computed. Each process says I have computed till this point. Okay? And if some process crashes, you see where have also, you stop everything. You see where did all the processes till, where have they reached in their computation, and restart them from that point. And then you don't have to restart from the beginning. That's the basic concept. If you could restart a computation from a previous checkpoint rather than from the very beginning, then you don't waste the CPU cycle redoing all of those computations. Okay. Now, question is, how do you ensure that whatever state you are checkpointing is in some sense consistent? Because you could basically, if processes are arbitrarily checkpointing without any coordination, you may actually do incorrect things. So this process checkpointed 1 hour ago, this checkpoint process checkpointed 5 minutes back, this process checkpointed 1 second back, and something crashed. If I take these arbitrary checkpoints and restart, then I may have inconsistencies. So one way to checkpoint, just one second, one way to checkpoint is I assume global synchronization. Everything is perfectly synchronized. Okay? So all processes agree that every hour on the dot they will checkpoint. So at noon everything pauses, every process takes a checkpoint, and everything restarts. Okay? This is consistent because everybody has checkpointed at exactly the same point in time because you have a globally synchronized clock. Okay. So now if some process crashes, I know everybody checkpointed at the same time, so everybody restarts from the same point, and everything is good. Okay. Is the problem solved? Do you have a global clock? We assume that there was a global clock, everything was synchronized and life is good. But in reality, there is no global clock. Okay. So you will run clock synchronization, but I said there will be errors, NTPS 50 millisecond error. So you can never pause at exactly the same time and take a snapshot or checkpoint your state. This doesn't happen in practice. Okay. So now you want an algorithm that will allow you to take a snapshot of the global state in the system without any clock synchronization at all. So you want to not assume that there is no clock synchronization because you cannot synchronize them perfectly. There's no such thing as a perfect clock synchronization algorithm. So how do you do this without assuming that there is any clock at all in the system? Yes.
When you make a checkpoint, you send a vector timestamp to everyone, and so everyone will keep track of where you were when the last checkpoint did, and keep track of all the messages you have to send.
Yes. So you are trying to sketch the algorithm. So we'll get there. No, that's the basic idea, but I'm just trying to motivate why you care about global state. You care about global state because you want to sometime restart computations not from the beginning but from some intermediate point, and you want to do this in a consistent fashion. Okay? So that's the problem of why you care about global state. Now the question is, how do you know what the global state is? That's what you are trying to sketch out, but that's the algorithm we will come to. Okay? So how do you figure out the global state of a distributed system when each process is independent and there is no global clock or no synchronization used in the system? Okay? That's the problem we want to address. Okay? And we want what is called a consistent global state. Of course, you could get an arbitrary state by saying you checkpoint whenever you want. You take everyone's checkpoint, not coordinated. That's not consistent. What you want is a consistent global state, and the algorithm to do this is called distributed snapshot. Okay. So here is a picture, but before I show you this picture, so this is what is actually happening. Okay. There is an analogy, I don't remember which paper it was in, so one of the papers that presented this idea maybe 20 years ago. So they gave the following analogy. Okay. So imagine there is sky and there are birds, lots of birds flying in the sky. Okay. and you want to take a picture of the sky. Now assume that your camera doesn't have a wide enough lens to take the picture of the entire sky in one snapshot. So the only way you will be able to do this is take individual pictures of different parts of the sky, and then you basically make a collage and you put these pictures together. And now you want to take what is called a consistent picture. What's a consistent picture? A consistent picture will have the following property. And assume that you want to capture really all the birds in the sky. Consistent set of snapshots will have a property such that every bird is in at least one picture. And no birds are missed. Then you have what's called a consistent. So all the birds in the sky, although you took this picture at different points in time, you have picked all of the pictures collectively, have captured all the birds exactly once, and you did not miss any of the birds that were in the sky at that point in time. This is consistent. If you violate either of those properties, if some bird appears in two pictures because it was in this picture when you pointed the camera here, now you are pointing the camera here, is actually flown to this point, now it's appeared in two pictures, inconsistent. Whereas you took a picture here, by the time you took a picture, some bird disappeared, and no picture has captured those birds, and again you have inconsistency. Same is going to be true here. Instead of birds, we are going to have messages. You will not have a snapshot in which a message is going to appear twice in any snapshot, in any local snapshot, because if a message appears twice, that's going to cause an inconsistency. We will also want to respect our simple property that the send must have occurred before receive. And last but not least, there is no global clock. So we are assuming that the snapshots are actually being taken at arbitrary points in time. So here are two pictures. Just to make this idea of taking a picture of the sky, now let's assume that there are three processes that want to take individual snapshots and capture the global state. And this is not an algorithm, this is just a picture. And what is shown are these processes are sending messages back and forth, and there's a dotted line. The dotted line basically intersects each process timeline. And we'll assume that whenever it intersects, that's where you have actually taken a checkpoint. And then there are two pictures here. The question is which of this is consistent and which one is not and why. So in particular, this process, because there is no clock synchronization, this process actually checkpointed, it stayed here. This process checkpointed, it stayed here. This process checkpointed, it stayed here. Different points in real time. And the same, there is a different cut shown there. This is called a cut, because you are cutting the timeline into two parts, the before part and the after part, and it is assumed that if any process crashes, this process is going to restart here, this process is going to restart here, and this process is going to restart here. Question is that consistent or not? So the claim is this is consistent, but this is not consistent, and we will understand why. So here is the reason why so to understand this, As I said, the reason a cut is not consistent is if you violate the property of send of a message has happened before the receipt. So in this cut, remember what is to the left of the dotted line is the before, what is to the right is after. So in this cut, the receipt of the message is in the before part, the send of the message is in the after part. So you have essentially violated this property. Now, what does violating this property mean? If you actually restart, so in this point, so these are the points where you are going to restart the three processes. In particular, process P2 restarts here after a crash has occurred, and it's going to continue computation. In particular, when it will reach this point of the computation, it's going to send M2. Now, process P3 is going to restart here. In this cut, process P3 has actually processed M2 already. So if you restart here and P2 restarts here, M2 is resent. P3 will receive two copies of M2. One that was already processed before the cut, and now after it restarted, the same message got reset. And the reason this is happening is because the receipt is in the before part and the send is afterwards. So you will basically resend. Typically, this cut should not have intersected here. It should have actually gone this way for it to have been consistent. In particular, so what this is showing is if any send and receive actually intersects the cut, the send better be in the before and the receipt has to be in the after. If it's the other way around, that's called an inconsistent cut. Okay, that's a message that you missed. It's like the bird that you missed in the sky. Okay, here also there is an intersection of a message. But in this case, the send is in the before and the receipt is in the after. So things are fine. This is a message in transit. Yes.
But that would mean that after, if you resume the process from the checkpoint, process people will not send it again because it's already sent, and process people will not receive it.
Okay. That's a good point. Okay, that was exactly the point I was going to make. So here the send is actually in the before and the receipt is in the after. Okay. Now if this process starts here, it's not going to resend us because that's earlier in the timeline. Okay. This process starts here, it has not yet received M3. But because that process is restarting after M3, it's not going to resend it. So where did this message go? Yes.
Probably it's like just sitting in a queue somewhere or something, it's probably both saved.
Yes. That was a message in transit. And let's go back to a definition of a global state. The global state of a distributed system is the local state of each process and the state of all of the messages in transit. Okay? So it is, what this is saying is it is not sufficient for you to just take local checkpoints. Somehow you have to go back to this queue that was being referred and also keep track of all the messages that are queued somewhere in the system. And those queues also have to be recreated. Because once a message has been sent, it's not going to be resent. If it hasn't been received, you better also record that it's not received and the message queue has to be also stored somewhere. Okay. This is why that definition is what it is. Okay. It's not only local state, but you have to checkpoint all of the messages that have been sent but have not been received. They are sort of in transit somewhere, sitting in a queue. So the state of those queues also have to be checkpointed. So you not only restart the process, recreate those queues. And those queues will eventually deliver those messages in transit, and then everything is consistent. Okay, that clear? Okay, so we have 5 minutes, and we can quickly go through the algorithm, but next time we can discuss it a little more. Okay, so let's not look at that. I'll draw a picture. Yes, so assume that there are processes A, B, C. They communicate with each other on bidirectional channel. Any process can send a message to any other process in the system. Okay? We'll assume that the channel guarantees reliable in-order delivery. Okay? Messages are not lost in the network. Okay? And the messages, if A is sending a sequence of messages, they are received in this order. TCP gives you this property already. So you can just assume these processes are communicating over TCP. Okay, very simple. Okay. Now our algorithm is as follows. Okay. We want to checkpoint a global state of this system. That means take a checkpoint of each process. That's the dump of its process, that process's memory contents. And you want to checkpoint all of the messages that are in transit, that are somewhere in the system, that have been sent, not received. Okay. And this very simply you will do the following. Any of these processes can start your distributed snapshot algorithm. Okay? So any process can start a distributed snapshot at any time. And as soon as you start the distributed snapshot, you first take a local snapshot. You just checkpoint your memory contents. Okay? And then you send out messages to all other processes that you can communicate with saying checkpoint. So on all your outgoing channel, you will send a checkpoint message. Okay? Whenever any process receives a checkpoint message, it will itself take a local checkpoint of its memory content, and then it will send checkpoint messages on all its outgoing channels. And process repeats. Right? The claim is when this algorithm ends, you will have a consistent snapshot. A very simple algorithm. Algorithm is anyone can start a distributed snapshot. You just checkpoint your memory content, send out messages to everyone else saying checkpoint, everyone you communicate with. Okay? When any process receives a checkpoint, okay, it the first time it's received this checkpoint, it will checkpoint and it will send out messages. Okay? So first thing is everybody is going to get a message at some point. It's a connected system because you are sending messages. You need not be fully connected. You could be partial, but it's a connected system. So everyone will eventually get a checkpoint message and you will checkpoint. Oh, there's one more thing I actually forgot to mention. Sorry? Not only stop infinite loop, but you have to, once you have received a checkpoint message, not only do you start, you do a local checkpoint, you also start checkpointing all messages that are coming into your queues. Okay, because you have to checkpoint all messages in transit. You keep recording messages on your incoming channel until you receive a checkpoint on that channel and you send out messages on the outgoing channel. So here is the algorithm. Any process can initiate the algorithm. You checkpoint local state and you send a marker on every outgoing channel. Upon receiving a marker, checkpoint the state if this is the first time you received the marker and send a marker on all outgoing channels. But also start recording what's coming in on your incoming channel until you receive a marker. On that, at that point, you have stopped. So what you have captured is your checkpoint as well as all of the messages that are in transit that have been coming into you until somebody sends you another checkpoint saying stop. Okay. That's the algorithm. Now I think there isn't enough time to explain why it works. So let me give you a quick intuition and then we'll come back and we will redo it. So first question was in infinite loops. You don't want this process to just keep sending these messages. Okay. So that is easy to do. The way you address infinite loops is if you have received a checkpoint from someone, checkpoint message from someone, on your outgoing you don't need to, you can just send, so let's make this bidirectional just so that it's clear. So each channel is bidirectional. So this guy has saved his state to this and he sent out checkpoint messages. Let's say B has received the checkpoint message, so it will save its state to disk. It is going to send checkpoint this way, it's going to send checkpoint this way, and it will start listening on its incoming channel. Every message that's coming here is going to be recorded. Okay? Until a checkpoint message arrives. So this checkpoint has gone here. So C is going to record its state, is going to send checkpoint on all the outgoing messages. In particular, it will send one in this direction. So all of these messages get recorded and this checkpoint causes B to stop recording. Okay. So question is, so it's clear that everyone is recording their local state. What may not be clear is why have you recorded all the messages that are in transit and only the messages that are in transit. Okay. Is that part, that's the part that we need to understand and then this is algorithm becomes clear. So question is, are we capturing all of the messages in transit? What are messages in transit mean? Yes.
Messages that are sent before the checkpoint?
Yes. Messages in transit are messages that have been sent but not received. That was the definition. So after your taker, so these are messages that B, for B, messages in transit are precisely those messages that have been sent after the checkpoint algorithm has started but has not yet been received. So after you have taken your checkpoint, there are still messages that are coming in. Those are the messages in transit, but not all of those messages are, only ones that were actually sent after the, while the checkpoint started are those messages. So you need to record, after you take your checkpoint, you need to record messages that are still coming in because those may be in transit. And you need to stop as soon as you know that there are no other messages in transit. So this should be clear. Question is, how do you know when to stop? Okay? You basically, all you do is you wait until, as soon as you have taken your local checkpoint, you start recording and you wait until a checkpoint message has been received. So to understand that, let's just take interaction between B and C. Okay, so let me erase this. Okay. First time B received the checkpoint message, it recorded its memory state and it started listening on this incoming channel. It also sent a checkpoint on the outgoing channel, okay, to C. So this message came here, this one has actually saved its state and then this will send a checkpoint message this way because that's an outgoing channel for C. So it should be clear that B will eventually get a checkpoint message back from C. If you send something, you will get back something. Because once that goes in, something has to come back. Okay, because that will trigger on all outgoing messages. Okay. Okay. Now the point is, all of the messages that are actually received here before this checkpoint are precisely the messages in transit. Okay. To understand that, you have to go back to this picture. Okay. This picture says that I send all of the messages that are actually going to cross this cut are the messages in transit. Okay. Any message that is sent and received is in completely in the before part is not a message in transit. It was sent and received before the checkpoint. Any message like M2 is a message that's completely in the after part. That's also not a message in transit. The only messages in transit are ones that actually cross the cut. Okay. And these are messages where that have been sent before your checkpoint, but were received after this guy's checkpoint. That's why it's crossing. Okay, because the send is in the before part, the receive is in the after part. So somebody has checkpointed after the send and you are checkpointed before the receive. Okay. Since from this process's perspective, this message M3 is going to arrive after its local checkpoint. That's precisely what's happening for B. We've taken a checkpoint and these messages are arriving afterwards. Okay. Is that clear? So those are essentially messages that cross the cut. Okay. The only issue that you have to remains is, when do you stop recording? Because if you just keep recording, you will also record messages that are completely in the after part. You don't want to do that. You only want to record messages that cross the cut. Okay. And the claim is this checkpoint marker that comes back to you on this channel is going to tell you precisely when to stop. Okay. And that tells you that because this checkpoint marker is sent as soon as this process takes a checkpoint. Okay? You know that once it has taken a checkpoint, there cannot be any more messages that cross that cut. Okay? Because once you have taken a checkpoint here, okay, all subsequent messages are in the after part. Okay? Because everything that you send after your checkpoint are in the after part. Only things that you send before are the ones that are crossing. So as soon as you take a checkpoint, you send this checkpoint message that demarcates the before and the after. Okay. So everything before that is in the before, everything after this checkpoint is in the after part. That's precisely what this checkpoint tells you. That record all incoming messages until a checkpoint message itself arrives on that channel. Okay. So I will reiterate a little bit of this next time because we ran out of time. But do go and review this material, okay, because it is important and some of it is non-trivial to understand. If you have questions, come back next time and ask. Okay, and we'll review this algorithm again next time.
So last sentence by the check.